Hey friends, welcome to the podcast. I'm excited to have you here today. Linda and I got to interview John Mark Comer and chat about his new book called Practicing the Way. And I began doing like sticky tabs, and I've just marked this book up quite a bit. It's been really good, and it's been really impactful for me in a really significant way. You know, sometimes you read a book just at the right time, and it can just, God can just use it in a way that can, really transform your life. And, I get to that later in the interview with him on something that I started doing, significant life change as a result of reading this book and then one other book kind of in conjunction together. So all that to say, John Mark is a thought leader and a really brilliant thinker. And I really enjoyed this conversation. And so I hope you do as well. So with that, let's get to it. Because this book, Practicing the Way, I've gone through it. It's really, really good. And I'm just really excited to chat about it. There's a lot of really great nuggets in here that I'm excited to chat about. So with all that, let's dive in. And I want to start with reading a little section from early on in the book. And I just want to get your comments on this, because I thought this was the first thing that jumped out at me as I was reading through. I'm like, this is really, really good. And this first thing is this idea here where it said, the thing is, the label Christian was one Jesus never used. He said, whoever wants to be my apprentice, not whoever wants to put your hand up to become a Christian. And then you go on to say that the problem is in the West, we've created a cultural milieu, which I don't even know how to pronounce, where
correct.
You can be a Christian, but not an apprentice of Jesus. And anyway, I just think this is such a powerful concept. So can you explain a little bit more of this idea?
Yeah, you know, thank God for editors. And, you know, they hide a bit of my sin. And there was a line right in that same section that they made me cut out, which was, what if Jesus wasn't a Christian? And that was a little bit too provocative. And all I was trying to say with that is, you know, I'm sure you know this and many listening know that the word Christian is not really used in the New Testament. It's there two or three times. It's never used by followers of Jesus who never self-identify as Christians in the New Testament. It was actually an insult, or worse, it was more of like a religious slur used by Greco-Romans or those or Jews or those hostile to the Christian way, as a kind of like a mocking term of, oh, you Christian, you little Christ, you want to be Jesus. And centuries later, you know, if you can't beat them, join them, right? So centuries later, followers of Jesus began to adopt this nomenclature and identify as Christians. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that word. It's actually, the meaning of the word is beautiful, a little Christ. I would love to be a little Christ. The problem is that the way the word is used in America, the modern West, the current English language, it does not mean anything appropriating or approaching a disciple of Jesus. A Christian just means, it means different things to different people. I literally read an interview a couple of weeks ago with a hardcore white supremacist who said, I am a strong Christian who has never been to church or read the Bible. I was like, so clearly, whatever he means by Christian is not what I think of when I hear the word Christian. But that just goes, that's proof of concept. That goes to, this word means different things to different people. And for most Americans today, Christian just means you have this rough Judeo-Christian view of kind of God and core Christian doctrine that at some mental level you rearrange the furniture of your mind to. Maybe it means you attempt to live kind of to be a good person. And maybe, though less and less, it means you go to church, whether on a weekly basis or Christmas and Easter kind of thing. That's all it means. It does not mean that you have seriously reorganized your entire life around intentionally learning to deepen your obedience to Jesus through loving relationship with him. And so I think we need to recapture the word that Jesus used, that the early followers of Jesus used, and there were multiple ones, but the most dominant one was mathetes in Greek. That is often, literally means learner. It's normally translated in our English translations of the Bible as disciple, and I like the translation apprentice. A number of Greek scholars think that English, in the English language, the word apprentice is the best word we have to translate what it means to be a mathetes. You are an apprentice of Jesus. And so there's this goofy time in history that we live in where due to a number of factors, from Christendom to the way the gospel has been presented for the last half a century, we live in a culture where, as I said, you can be a Christian but not an apprentice of Jesus. And I'm just trying to lovingly, gently, but firmly say there are not two categories in the New Testament. Yep. There's one. Come and follow me. And that's what we are invited into.
Yeah, and it's so good. And wow. I feel like you kindly and lovingly and gently do that very well throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
I want to touch on something that you said on page 46. We were just talking about this before the call. Let me pull that up real quick.
Bro, this is next level. You just used page number. I can't tell you how many interviews I do. They've clearly not read the book. I'm like, all right, I'm just grateful to be on. But, you know, this is, I'm just filling a slot for you.
I've read the book. I found the stuff jumping off the page at us. So, anyway, do you want to read this?
That's not page 46.
It's 41. We're close. We're close enough. Let's just start reading words on page 41.
Oh, see, you didn't have the page number memorized. All right. This is
I don't have it memorized yet.
Free time money again.
Your editor's got that, but we're not quite there yet. But anyway, so it was about this idea. Like, you mentioned this thing. There's something here that heals wounds better than the church, Bible study, and therapy. And I thought this was so powerful. And it's this quote from David Brenner, and he said, "Meditating on God's love has done more to increase my love than decades of effort to try to be more loving. Allowing myself to deeply experience his love, taking time to soak it in and allow it to infuse me, has begun to affect changes that I have given up hope of ever experiencing. Coming back to God and my failures at love, throwing myself into his arms and asking him to remind me of how much he loves me as I am. Mm-hmm. Here I begin to experience new levels of love to give others." Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on that quote.
So good.
Yeah. Oh, no, I love it. I mean, there's a lot we could explore here, you guys, but I grew up in a church tradition that I'm really grateful for. I'm not angry about it. I'm genuinely grateful. But where it was clear that, you know, the end goal of spiritual formation, or we would have called it sanctification, of discipleship to Jesus is, you know, the great commandment to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. That love was the telos. It was the end goal of the journey. But sadly, the kind of vehicle for the journey, or what psychologists would call the theory of change, It was basically know and learn and study the Bible and then go do it. There would have been beautiful theological statements that would have shielded that by saying things like, rely on the Spirit, you can't do this without God, it's a work of grace. All true theologically, but there was no way to access them pragmatically. Like, grace is something that we have, but we have to learn how to, in theological, like in like hardcore academic language, you have to learn how to appropriate grace. Just like, here I am, I sit at my desk. This is my debit card. So behind this debit card, I just got paid a couple days ago. I got my monthly paycheck. There's money in an account somewhere that I have. I have, it has been deposited into my account. But I need a method to access, if I want to actually go buy gas for my car or dinner for my family, it's not enough that I have money in my account. I need a way to access it. And I think that's oversimplification, but we have grace. We have the power of the Holy Spirit. We have new life and access to the kingdom of God and participation in the inner life of the Trinity. But how do we access it? And it's like I was given this wealth and told about the wealth through preaching and teaching, but nobody gave me a debit card. You know, nobody gave me much less a life budget to appropriate it correctly. And so that's what a lot of this book is trying to do. And that David Benner quote, what I love about that is, I think as a general rule, we become, I think if you had a good Christian therapist on the show, I think they would say something like, we are loved to the degree that we have, we are loving to the degree that we have been loved. You know, for example, mm-hmm. for people that are well loved by their parents and caregivers through all of their earliest years, who grew up in that vanishing gift of a normally dysfunctional family. All families are dysfunctional, but you know, normal health is a function of the immune system kind of family, that kind of healthy, and are loved and are safe and are cared for, and there's laughter and joy and safety and security and a launch pad for life. Those people tend to find a much easier way to just trust people and love people and give to people and sacrifice for people. Whereas people that grew up in deeply dysfunctional and broken kind of systems of early relationships, who were not safe or who were wounded or abused, they find it much harder to trust, to love, to self-extend. Now, that the good news, that's where the good news of the gospel comes in. There is no family that was ever healthy enough to possibly form us into people of love like Jesus. And there is no family that was ever dysfunctional or toxic or abusive or horrible enough to ever keep us from becoming people of love like Jesus. We may start from different places, but we all have to go on this spiritual journey. And as a general rule, the way we become more loving is not by hearing sermons about God's love or reading books like mine about God's love or listening to podcasts where we talk about God's love. It's by experiencing the love of God. Yeah. And the two primary mediums that comes through are forms of contemplation or meditation through prayer and scripture and through deep loving relationships. When I have a dear friend who knows deeply my shadow and my brokenness, or my wife who knows my sin better than anybody. And when she still forgives me and loves me and even calls out good in me when she knows just how ugly I actually am when I'm not on a podcast and trying to be better than I really am. And that experience of love through my wife, through my closest friends, through prayer, that is what is so deeply transformative in the journey to become people of love. So that's what I loved about that quote. It's why I put it in there, and it's why I so appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I let me know what you think about this, but I feel like that extends into other things besides just love. Obviously, that is a huge one, because God is love. And, you know, we can't know everything about him without understanding that he loves us and how he loves us and, you know, whatever. But like I was thinking about in Acts 4:13, where it talks about Peter and John, they're unlearned men, and yet they're marveling. People are marveling at them because they realize that they had been with Jesus.
Right.
And just that idea of learning things that maybe we can't learn any other way other than experiencing them through the word, the contemplation of the word, and, you know, just being with God, don't you think?
Yes. Yes. There are certain things you simply, there's no shortcut and there's no other path.
Yeah.
It's the Jesus is the path, being with him. I mean, that's the thing, is we're such deeply relational creatures by God's design, that we become like who we are around. You know, we have three kids in high school. How do you guys have any kids? How old are they? Roughly
10, 7. Wait, just about 7.
Yeah. 5, 7, and 10.
5, 7, 10. There it is. So we have three teenagers, believe it or not. We had started pretty young. So we have a senior in high school and two freshmen in high school. It's just nuts in our house right now. And it's a lot of fun and a lot of drama and chaos and anxiety. But all three of our kids, especially, I think this is true of humans in general. It's true of adolescents even more so. And one of our kids in particular, it's especially true of. He's just so deeply influenced by his social environment, by the people around him. The problem is he's like a high school kid going to school in West LA. And let me just tell you, that is not a super edifying social environment.
It's not Franklin, Tennessee.
Of the kids, no, it's not Franklin, Tennessee. Most of these kids are just secular, you know, pot smoking, video game playing, girl chasing adolescent males. Like that's who he is around all of the time. And he's a good kid. Yeah. He's doing well. But he is influenced by that. It has a deformative effect on him. And I took him last week to a men's retreat that a friend of mine put on. And I'm not like a men's retreat kind of guy. It's just I'm very introverted. But we went on this retreat. It was 40 guys out at this ranch, all serious Jesus dudes, all a bit older. And I just saw my son come alive. And it was like, not like he was a different person. It was actually like he was his best self. He was his true self. And it showed me, wow, so much of the problems that, you know, frustration we have with him and he has with us are his environment. He's being so deeply influenced by the wrong kinds of things. But you put him in a different environment of 40 guys all pursuing Jesus for 4 days. We literally turned our phones in for the whole thing. No phone, no people, just us on a ranch loving Jesus and going after deep, meaningful connection for 4 days. It's like this whole other part of him came alive. And so this whole process is so deeply relational. And that's where both prayer and Christian community are so central. As we are with Jesus, a whole other part of us comes awake and comes alive. You know, you think of, you know, when you get all, that's why genders are so important. If you get all guys in a room, the maturity tends to just plummet. Like the topics of conversation tend to just,
it's so true.
They just go so primal so fast. And one woman rocks into a room where six guys are having a cigar around the fire or whatever. And instantly the whole atmosphere changes. Like, and all it calls men up to, like, hopefully be more gentlemanly or whatever, you know? And so I think that can happen in prayer, where as we are exposed to Jesus, he resets the atmosphere in the room, and we are all of a sudden begin to be transformed, to be more like him. He brings new facets out of us and brings them forward in our character and our development. And hopefully that's what happens in Christian community, where it brings out new facets of who we are beautifully drawn out and grown up and more firmly planted in our character.
Yeah. That's so good. And so you mentioned prayer there, and I want to address something here, because you talked about a mistake that I think a lot of Christians make in their prayer life, and it's this idea of always running your mouth while you're praying. And I want to read what you wrote on page 48 here.
Oh, I like how you said it, though. That's how Franklin would say it. I should have put that in. Yeah. Running your mouth. Yeah. What a great line.
Yeah. So anyways, you said this. It's not that words in prayer are bad. They aren't. It's just that you reach a point in any relationship, but especially with God, where words and even thoughts no longer carry you forward towards intimacy. Mm. They bring you so far, but not all the way. They may even hold you back.
Yeah.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, let me see if I can do this without being inappropriate or awkward. But the contemplative tradition, you're like, wait, what's coming? You're like, you have power of edit, right? You have power of edit on your side. The contemplative tradition, going all the way back to ancient Jewish readings of the Song of Solomon, has long said that marriage and marital union is the ultimate picture of union, what the ancient Christians called union with God. And in every marital relationship, I mean, the church is called the bride of Christ, you know? Mm-hmm. And in every marital relationship, talking and communication is essential. Like, you never mature beyond talking to each other. You know what I mean? You never reach to a plane of maturity in your marriage where you don't need to talk to each other, ask each other for help, bear burdens with one another, think about each other, email each other and text each other when you're out of town. But there is a level of intimacy where you have to stop talking and you have to go beyond words. And even beyond thoughts, in a sense, to direct person-to-person love and union. And the mystics have all said, without being crass or without being uncouth, that, you know, sexual union in a marriage is in many ways the ultimate physical icon, is the word that Eastern Christians and Catholic Christians would call it, an icon. It's like a picture or a window into union with God and into prayer. And so there is a type of prayer, just like there is a type of love and a level of intimacy in marriage that goes beyond thoughts and words. There is a type of prayer that goes beyond thoughts and words to direct spirit-to-spirit union with God. And in the same way that if you were married and had never been one in that way together, people would consider it a great travesty. Yeah. And if you are a Christian or a disciple and you have never been in a contemplative way with God, and are not regularly in a contemplative, abiding union with God, then you are missing out on this great joy. That's not the whole of Christian spirituality, but it is certainly at the heart of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So. And I find for a long time, I feel like that was my problem, is I would just talk, and then move on to the next thing. And it was like, once I stopped doing that,
stopped running your mouth.
Once I, shut up is what I would like to say. I just, it's like, just stop. I'm hearing this. Just I want to hear this.
Yep. I mean, can you imagine your marriage if all you did was just talk the whole time and then walk out of the room? It would not.
Yeah.
First off, it would not last.
Well, I can't.
But there's
imagine
a step
it
between, actually.
My kids do it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, you are so right.
All the time.
Is so. I remember a parent saying to us when our kids were younger. I still think about it all the time because my teenagers do it. It's just about different things. But they said you have to listen to your kids talk at you when they're talking about, you know, in our era, it was like Lightning McQueen and G.I. Joes or whatever.
Yeah.
Because then when they're later, like they won't talk to, when they're older, when they're adolescents, they won't talk to you at all, you know? So I've just been, Lord, I just keep waiting. The other day, one of my kids asked me a question. They're like, Dad, how are you doing emotionally in this season of your work? And I just, my jaw just about fell through the floor. I was like, it's possible. I've been waiting 18 years for this question and it finally came.
Yeah.
But all that to say, you know, there's still a in prayer, I don't want to call it a step because it's not like a step process, but there's still a step between talking and being is the step of listening. So there, you know, there's talking to someone, then there's a whole aspect of prayer that is listening to God and learning to like really listen for God's voice in the quiet and through the circumstances of your life. And then beyond that is this further step, layer, dimension, I don't know what the right word is, of just being with God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
So when we were at the Art of Teaching conference that you did in Franklin a few months back, you said something, so I was taking notes, we were both there, and you said something that just shook me. And I know it was for me because I so desperately need this, but, and again, I'm taking notes, you know, I'm, you know, being led by God and what he's downloading into me as you're talking. So it might not be word for word what you said, but what I took from it was this idea that we must choose the way of renunciation. And so at that conference, you're talking to leaders, you know, and you're essentially making this point that we can't do everything. We can't be everyone. And one thing that you also said is it requires you to accept that you'll have to live many unlived lives. And when you said that, something just hit me because this has been one of my greatest challenges because I am a person who
Has a million hobbies.
I have a million hobbies. I love learning about everything. I love doing everything. I wish I could live to be 500 years old because there's so much I want to do. And
he means it.
And it's painful to
Elon Musk will figure that out for you. By the time you're dead, he'll have some company to make you live forever.
Oh my gosh, you're right. Yeah, it's painful to admit that there are things that I want to do, I might even have an aptitude for, might even have a gifting for, that I have to lay down on the altar and focus and choose, or I won't fulfill God's best in my life. And anyway, I'm assuming since you talked about that, you might have dealt with some of this. I'd love to hear just a little bit more of your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, first off, I think we have to hold this call to renunciation through the prism. We have to view it through the lens and the prism of Christian theology, which is that we're following the pattern of death, burial, resurrection. And this life is not all there is. And in fact, this life is not even, this is just a short preparation for the age to come. And that's where, you know, the Stoics talk about the life of renunciation. I'm sure you could interview Ryan Holiday and he'd have some fantastic, good, helpful things to say about renunciation, discipline, career, vocational focus, not doing too many things. You know, you could have the Minimalist Podcast guys on. They would all have good wisdom to offer, but it would be through the lens of you get one life to live and then you die. And maybe Elon Musk will elongate it and then we'll die later and not earlier, you know? So we have to view this, we have to have this conversation through the lens of there are things we have to die to, but death is not the end of the story. And if you're a hobbies guy, I think you'll have plenty of time long term. Right now we're all time poor. We all have this poverty of time. We don't have enough time. And we will not always be time poor. There will come a day when we are time rich. And that's a real gift to look forward to that. But yes, there's no version of discipleship. There's certainly no version of vocational, if you want to use the word mastery, excellence, putting love into whatever the work that you do is, that does not require, there's no version of parenting that does not require the way of renunciation, that does not require, if you're going to be a good mom, that means you're going to be a bad lots of other things, or a good dad, it means you're going to miss out on a lot of other things. I mean, a dear friend of mine, we've just moved, but who is kind of my closest brother, community member for many, many years in our home community, lived across the street from each other for many years in Portland. He was in business and I was in the serving as a pastor, both the same age and both had some, you know, good outcomes by external metrics in the work that we were doing. And we would talk a lot about how this conspiracy, and this is more true for the traditional male life arc than the common female life arc, which tends to be a little bit different because of parenting. But so forgive the gender specific analogy here. But we would talk a lot, and in the developmental psychology around children, you know, this probably doesn't sound very politically correct, but this is just like the scientific literature would say children's primary kind of emotional home goes from mom to dad to mentor. And that doesn't map great onto current political or social sensibilities, but that's just what the scientific literature would say, that children always need a mom, always need a dad, but primarily orient toward mom in the younger years, then dad in the middle years, and then mentors. And there's not specific ages, but it's about 9 to 16 is about the dad, kind of optimal dad range, where like there's a real orientation toward dad. And all that to say, those years come right when most men in a Western middle class context are at the peak of their career, peak of their earning potential. And so every day, I actually have less emotional availability and hours that I can put into my, quote, career or work now than I have ever had. When I was young, before I had kids, I worked insane hours. Even when they were pretty little, I would work really hard. And when I came home, I had to change diapers and get them to bed. But I didn't have to navigate complex emotional decisions with them and all the stuff I'm having to do now that's very emotionally draining. And so every day I face the point I'm making is every day as a 43-year-old dad with three teenagers, I face the temptation to prioritize my job, my work, my own aspirations over my calling to be a dad. And the thing about work is it is much more controllable and much more like I'm at the peak of my career. It's a gross word for a pastor to use, but I'm at the peak of my work, whatever word you want to use, where I could pretty direct line of link. I can go do this thing and these good outcomes will come. Parenting does not work like that. Often I go do all the right things and it still doesn't go very well. Or I try my best to do the right thing and I still utterly fail and end up just apologizing to them. Happens all of the time. And so what's called for every parent is the way of renunciation. Am I going to renounce up and to the right, prioritizing my work over my children or not? And So this parable goes, whether you're a Christian or not, this is a truism that God wove into the fabric of the human condition. But for us who follow Jesus and adopt the cruciform way of life of death, burial, and resurrection as the central paradigm and even rhythm that we live by, the way of renunciation in our discipleship, in our work, and in our closest relationships and more is utterly central and essential to living a life, a resurrection life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so good.
Man, that is good. Well, and I feel like it kind of this teases us into this idea of how do you say no to what you're saying? It's the peak of your career or your, you know, whatever you want to call it, that thing where men feel like, it is my responsibility to provide for my family and this is how I'm doing it. And really, it's saying no to time with your children in order to say yes to a dollar amount. And I think that that is a really difficult choice for people to make, especially when it's their desire to want to provide. There is a godly drive there. But then also I think we can get it just a little bit off in thinking that it all depends on me. If I don't get this done, then it won't happen. When really we should be looking to God as our provider to do all those things, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think what you just touched on at the end is one of the great lies of American Christianity, and it's the belief that the parent, or often more specifically in certain church streams, the father is the provider of the family. And often people even try to cite that from Scripture. And that is a minor heresy. God is the provider. There's one person that's called provider in the library of Scripture, and it's God. God is our provider. Jesus is not saying in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, look at the birds of the air. The dad works really hard, and he provides for the family and so they can relax. That's not what he says.
Yeah.
He says the father knows what they need. And he's referring to God, not to the dad. And mom and dad are both called of God to work their butts off. And in certain family units, like mine, I am the prime, you know, income comes through the work I do more than through the very important work that my wife does. But we both work really hard. But God is our provider, not me, not my wife.
Yeah.
And so there's a theological reorientation that we have to get to. We have a calling to work and be responsible, but God is our provider, and we never provide. We receive all that we receive as a gift. And then, you know, there's a pragmatic outworking of this. If most Americans I know are living so far above their means or above what they need to live happy, peaceful, meaningful lives that they're creating these lifestyles that require chronic overwork, require the prioritization of career over family. People are often chasing a career through transients from city to city to city. And I understand, we've just moved. There is a time when you have to follow God's call, but often people just assume, I'm going to move my family around every 5 years to chase the next best job, rather than, you know what I mean, being rooted and planted in a place and a community and let your children grow up to flourish and thrive. And I'm not saying this in some dogmatic black and white way. I'm just saying so much of this is exacerbated by people's adoption of the traditional American life script and pursuit of more money, more square footage, more new things, more vacations, more experiences, more clothing, I mean, whatever it is. And if we could live more simply, more slowly, more gratefully, more rootedly, I don't think that's a word, but, you know, more rooted, then we could just, at a very pragmatic level, we could just cut off a huge chunk of our stress and hurry and deficient relationships. And so, again, that's the way of renunciation. You know, are you going to choose to make less money and live on a lower budget and live with less social mobility in order to live in alignment with your deepest values? And that is a temptation that, you know, some of it's class-based. I hate to talk about that, but some people don't even get the luxury of having this conversation. and we need to really honor them.
Right.
But some of us, it is a decision that we make. And in my case, I decide if I'm going to go do a certain level of work that I don't need to do to make a living for whatever reason. They might even be good reasons. Or if I'm going to say, no, I'm done. I'm a dad.
Yeah.
We got a roof over our head. I don't need a new car. Here we are, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, we need to let you go. I know you got to run, but I want to finish up real quick just by talking a little bit about this book. So this book has come to me at the perfect time. And so I just finished, I also finished listening to your friend Tyler's book, Praying Like Fools.
Oh, lovely. Yes.
Absolutely beautiful. Fantastic. And the combination of these two at the same time has really, really impacted me. And just quick backstory, like, God called us 7 years ago to take a one-year sabbatical, step away from our business. Big, bold act of faith that we didn't know what was going to happen.
Crazy.
And
love it.
We ended up doing it, and God saw us through the whole thing miraculously, and it was life-changing, pivotal moment in our lives, and no doubt we'll look back on that. Anyway, and this was all based off of Leviticus 25, letting the land rest every 7 years type of thing. And so we're seven years later right now. And out of this book and out of Tyler's book and what you're talking about here in the rule of law, like I ended up, the Lord just kind of led me to this idea of this year, which is to be a new Sabbath rest year for me, even though I'm not going to completely step away from work. What I feel he's called me to is something called retired by noon.
And so until noon.
Retired. Yeah. Until noon.
Yes.
And so essentially that is going to be my rule of life. Is that who you called it?
Wow.
That I am going to be maintaining throughout the year that I've already been doing a few weeks and is just breathing so much life into me, having that structure of rest, having that structure. So I'm saying all this to say the book is fantastic. I really appreciate the work that you put into it. It's deeply impacting us.
Bob and Linda, the frustrating thing with podcast interviews is you spend 45 minutes chatting to someone and then you realize I'd like to hang out with them for dinner and spend a couple more hours getting to know you.
Next time you're in Nashville,
this has been a one-sided conversation, which is no fun at all. And so I hope we get the chance for a two-sided conversation with no red recording button in the background at some point, because you two carry such a brevity and lightness and joyful kindness about you. It's really an honor to be on, and thank you for the work that you're doing, and may God deeply install peace into your soul as you are retired until noon in the
Well, amen. I appreciate it. Everybody run out and grab a book, Practicing the Way. Fantastic book. Grab Ruthless Elimination of Hurry if you haven't read that as Also awesome. But
if you're one of the five people who haven't read that book yet.
But anyway, John Mark, we appreciate you. Have a great day.
Yes, thank you.
Bless you guys. Thank you.
So if you liked this episode or just our podcast in general and you want to hang out with us more, what about for 6 weeks in a row with your small group or church?
Yeah, we'd love that. That sounds fun to us. Uh-huh. So if that is interesting to you, just head over to seedtime.com/true to get all the details of how we can do that and how we can serve your small group, serve your church, or also just send us a message on Instagram @seedtime or send me an email, bob@seedtime, and we can chat.